Welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host, and I thank you so much for joining us on this special broadcast. It's the return of Greg Braden, and we are going to continue our conversation regarding his book, Fractal Time, demystifying, if you will, all of the fears and woes and what have you of 2012. And we're going to talk about a few other things as well. A reminder that Tell Me Your Story comes your way Saturdays from 3 to 4 p.m. Pacific Time. We stream live on the internet at richarddugan.com, and we archive the programs at the radio show's page of richarddugan.com. We encourage you to send us an email, richard@richarddugan.com, and we encourage you to join us every Saturday as we talk with those folks who are bringing us new paradigms for a new world. And Greg, I got to tell you, I am so thrilled to have you back on the program today. This is just so exciting.
Absolutely. Richard, I'm thrilled to be on the program. It's good to hear your voice, and I'm really excited about this the material that we're going to be able to cover with our audience today. So thank you for having me back.
Fractal Time, The Secret of 2012 and a New World Age. First of all, that subtitle, in reference to a new world age, that's got to put a certain element of concern on the part of some religious, because that's the last thing they want is a new world order. They've heard that term used over and over again in terms of, for example, the symbology of the Antichrist and Armageddon, and again, the list goes on, the end times. And so how do you define the new world age?
Well, the term world age is very different from the term world order. And I think some people may mesh the two together because of their similarity. The world order or new world order is a political term that has arisen within the last, the early part of the 20th century.
Yeah.
That has frightening implications for some people about the forcing of the forced unifying of a unified world of a government and a ruling class, a ruling society of monetary systems and things like that. Those are typically ideas that are associated with the term world order, a new world order. The new world age is very different. The new world age is a Mayan term, and it's a Mesoamerican term. I'll be very specific. Mesoamerican and Mayans we're talking about today. But the Mesoamerican traditions through the Southwest, through the Yucatan, Mexico, down into the Andean civilizations, they viewed what is called this great world age that we're ending as part of what is known as a doctrine of world ages. And the doctrine of world ages, that's the fancy term for what we've already spoken about in this program, the idea that civilizations rise and fall on a cyclic basis driven by astronomical events that change the way we live life here on Earth. And as we said earlier, entire cycles of war and peace and the rise and fall of civilizations are now being linked to these 5,000-year, roughly 5,000, that they we round them for convenience, but it's 5,125-year world age cycles that are talking about. So we are living the close of a world age, and by definition, the birth of a new world age. When we look at the cycles, we said earlier that we're talking about cycles within cycles. When we look at Earth's position in the heavens, as we continue our journey, our orbit around the center of our Milky Way galaxy, our planet goes through a number of different motions in that orbit. And one of those motions is what's called a very long, slow wobble, just kind of the way a child's top, when you spin it and you release it on the floor, it doesn't stay vertical. It actually goes through a wobble as it's moving and spinning along the floor. Earth does something very similar in the heavens. And one complete wobble of our planet takes about 26,000 years. So it's a very slow wobble. And at the end of that 26,000-year wobble, we will have the scenery of the heavens, if you're standing on the earth, changes over those 26,000 years. So if you're standing on what you're in Santa Barbara, if you're standing in Santa Barbara looking at the sky and you can stand there for 26,000 years, you're going to see the stars. The stars in the night sky are going to change, and you will see different constellations become apparent.
Yeah.
And it is this wobble, at the end of this 26,000-year wobble, we will go through all of the 12 constellations of the zodiac, so the age of Aries and the age of Cancer and the age of Pisces, the Aquarian age that we're moving into.
Mm-hmm.
We'll go through all of those at the end of this 26,000-year wobble. This is interesting because what the indigenous peoples, and specifically the Mayans, are telling us is that, yes, we are living the end of a 5,000-year cycle, but it happens to be the fifth 5,000-year cycle, which is also completing the 26,000-year cycle as well. So that is what makes this time especially unique. Not only are we living the end of one world age, but it's the fifth of five world ages that have comprised this one big wobble, and now we're starting another wobble.
Mm.
How they would even know that, to even be able to document this stuff, and the ideas are just mind-boggling, but we see very clear evidence in the temple walls in Egypt, for example, in the indigenous traditions, that they were aware of our relationship to nature and to the world in terms of these vast cycles of time and how we could expect these changes to occur.
Well,
many of the indigenous traditions are very earth-based traditions, mm-hmm. and they tend to look at changes in the earth to tell us about the cycle. So, you know, they'll say your cycle is completing when you see the birth of a white buffalo on the plains of North America, for example.
Right.
When you can't grow corn in Kansas in August anymore, that's how you know the yeah. end of the cycle is coming. But we are drawn to the Maya because they thought very similar to the way that we do. They used mathematics, they used numbers that can be confirmed today, and their cycles were linked to astronomical events that we can also confirm, to alignments in the heavens, to solstice and equinox events, to eclipses. They knew precisely when these events were happening, and we can confirm them. So scientists tend to relate to those kinds of things a little better than they do the birth of a white buffalo.
And we'll continue our interview with Greg Braden here on Tell Me Your Story. Don't go away.
Keeping all that fear inside. I understand how trouble haunts you. It haunts me too. Yes, and I do know how you feel. Oh, come on, walk with me. Talk with me.
Welcome back to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan with my special guest, Greg Braden, author of Fractal Time. Let's get right back into our questions. Greg?
Let me ask you, in light of 2012. All right, it's 2012 by our calendar, okay? Did we make the right calculations, shifts, changes, etc., so that we're looking at the right period in time right now?
That's a very good question that I asked myself early on. As a scientist, because we've covered so much ground in what you just said here, and one of the keys, first of all, is that because of the shifts in the way we track time, we really don't know what year this is. I mean, it sounds crazy to say that, but when the church changed the way that went from rhythms of nature to tracking time, they went to 30-day interest cycles for business reasons. And it was when the idea of interest on money and loans was actually put into place, we slipped. It wasn't a real clean match, and so we slipped some dates. And depending on whose interpretation you read, we may be lost as much as a few years. It may be 2 years, 3 years, 4 years. What that says is that from the kinds of numbers we're used to looking at, we could be closer to this 2012 than we think we are. But the reason that's probably not so is because the Mayan calendar was based on, first of all, there is no single Mayan calendar. The Mayan system of timekeeping was a number of different calendars that overlap and interface. And you're right, Richard, it takes some study to really be able to use it in a meaningful way. And it's still used today, by the way. People in the Yucatan and through the Mesoamerican traditions, they still set their clocks, they plant their crops by these traditional systems of timekeeping that link cosmic cycles to everyday cycles of our lives. So it's not an obsolete system of timekeeping by any means. But they linked the end of the last cycle. It was actually August of 3114 B.C. is when the last world age ended and the new one began. And they linked it to an astronomical event that is verifiable. We can still verify it today with our computers. And they then knew precisely how many days would elapse until the next world age cycle completed and the new one began. So we essentially have been on a countdown from the Mayan perspective. They don't give it a date. They count the number of days that have elapsed from the last world age completion to the end of this cycle. So we have been on this countdown, and when we take their numeric system, this was done in the 1920s, I believe it's called, I think it was 1928, it's called the GMT conversion for the Mayan system of timekeeping. Three scholars whose last names were represented by the GMT, but they were able to translate the Mayan system of timekeeping, and when they overlaid that onto the way we now look at time, that's where the 2012 end date came from. The Mayans never knew. They didn't, you know, you don't see a Mayan hieroglyph that says, look out for the year 2012. What they're doing is simply counting dates.
Yeah.
Through a system of time called the Dzogchen. There's a lot of study, maybe some of your guests have talked about this calendar called the T-Z-O-L-K-I-N, the Dzogchen. And it's based on just a number, a five-part code, and each part of the code is carries a different element of time. It goes from there's a one-day factor and a 20-day factor and a 360-day factor. And so rather than looking at a specific date, the Mayans were simply counting days. And the day that they ended up with happens to coincide for us with the date of 2012. And I hope that makes sense, but it's a good question. It's a really good question.
Greg, if we are to continue to pursue and investigate this 2012 and want to get to the heart of what this all is all about. You said that this cycle, granted 5,000 years, the transition began back in the, say, early mid-80s. And I think there was an event they referred to as the harmonic convergence and these kinds of things that happened from a celestial standpoint. And that we're more than halfway through it, that we're supposed to be, say, on the other side of this transition around 2016, if I'm not mistaken. What can we look for in as far as, say, the signs that we're on the other side of it?
Well, this is where, it's a good question, and this is where, for me, if we want to move beyond guessing and speculation and prophecy and prediction of others, then we need to look at the evidence, at the concrete evidence, as we understand that evidence today, left in the history of the Earth and in the history of the people upon the Earth, the civilizations of the past. And what as we mentioned earlier, the ice cores in Antarctica are a really good place to begin that investigation. And what they tell us is, and I talk about this in the book Fractal Time, we identify specifically the anomalies that we're looking at now, in terms of the temperature of the oceans, the temperature of the Earth, the atmosphere, the magnetic intensity of the Earth's magnetic fields, or the intensity of Earth's magnetic fields, the radiant energy from the sun, the where the sea levels are. So when we look at the records of the ice cores from the past, what we find is that the parameters that our own scientists now are so concerned about, they're telling us that have changed anomalously now, and they have, if we're only looking within the last, 100 or 200 years. But when we look at the big picture, these parameters put us right into the place where we always are when we reach the end of one of these world age cycles. The magnetic fields always drop within the range of where they are right now. We can talk about that a little bit more in a few minutes. The temperatures of the planet always rise 1 to 2 degrees Celsius, which is what's happened. The sea levels always rise. The ice always begins to melt, maybe not to the degree that it's melted now, and that's caused some concern. But the fact that the ice is melting, the sea levels are rising. The radiant energy from the sun always increases, which is driving a lot of the temperature changes and the melting of the ice. So all of these anomalies, the things that look anomalous to us, they put us right into the zone, into the range of where Earth always is when we reach the end of one of these cycles. And then if we follow that pattern through in its and we see where that pattern leads, all of these conditions sort of plateau, and then they typically begin to move in another direction. So the Earth begins to cool rather than warm, and there are a number of scientists, there's a growing concern of scientists now, and there are petitions that are circulating in the scientific community saying that that is what's happening, and we need to be preparing for the cooling trend and the problems that come with cooling, because it appears that the warming now has plateaued. So it fits these previous models. So what we can expect is that a stabilization of the changes, not so much of a radical swing and the extremes and temperature and, heat extremes in the summer and tons of snow in the winter, less of that as we move through this cycle. And as those things stabilize, then we begin anew. And this is what happened. Our ancestors wrote to us through the last cycle, and it appears to be what the geologic and archaeological records are telling us about from cycles before. But the key, so we get through the physical changes. The key, as I mentioned earlier, is how we have responded to those changes. In our fear, do we contract and grab all of the last vestiges of the resources and an unsustainable way of life to help ourselves to feel better and say everybody else is on their own? Or do we come together as individuals, as a society, as a civilization, as a planet, and we say, look, we're living something that no humans have lived since the biblical era. We'll get through it, mm-hmm. but we've got to work together to get through it really, really well. And I am optimistic because I'm seeing that happen. It's a long, circuitous path. I don't know why we've taken the tough roads and made the difficult choices that we've made. But I'm seeing the movement toward people recognizing that this isn't business as usual and something is very different now. And it behooves us to work together. It's in all of our interests to work together to transcend differences that have led to our separation in the past, and to work together to get through this time and maybe get to know each other a little bit better as we do so.
Well, I know that I've stated before on this program that if it were intended that each of us was supposed to live solitary lives, that there certainly are enough planets in the universe for each one of us to occupy a planet all by ourselves.
I never thought about it that way, Richard.
However, logically thinking, obviously that wasn't the case, because guess what? We're all here. Yeah. So your conclusion is the only one that I could come to, that we're here to live and work and love and play together here and to coexist, not to try to destroy one another. And as you're stating to us, it's not those events that we need to be focusing on, but how we as individuals and collectively as a society face and handle and deal with those challenges.
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, Richard, it's fascinating to me, and I think that what we're talking about now is so relevant to every aspect of our lives that there's nothing, no topic could be brought into this conversation that wouldn't be relevant. So I'm doing my best to stick to the conversation at hand, but I think it's very significant. Between 1995 and the year 2003, there were over 400 peer-reviewed scientific studies published in technical journals that asked the same question, and they arrived at the same answer, 400 independent studies. The question was this: in a population of living beings, living things, living creatures, what is the optimum amount of competition that will contribute to the longevity of that population? And in every one of the studies, the answer that came back was the same. It was zero. Every single time, what they found was that cooperation always, always, always benefited the populations, whether they were talking about amoeba or whether they were talking about animals in game reserves in Africa or whether they were talking about animals with eagle populations and no boundaries in North America or condors in South America, or whether we're talking about people working with resources in Africa. Always that zero competition, cooperation, best benefited the populations in the long term. And so the question is, are we so different as a civilization that those principles don't apply to us? And when I say competition, I'm not talking about a friendly game of soccer, you know, or football, but this is violent competition where people kill one another over what they perceive as a finite number of resources.
Wow.
Rather than working together to find new ways.
Yeah.
So now there's another element here. This is where it's important for me to always step back and take in the perspective all the things that are happening. Now, the best minds of our time, there was a symposium that was convened in the year 2005, before the economic crash and before many of the crises that were really identified publicly that we're looking at now, a symposium of scientists, engineers, architects, social architects, philosophers, spiritual leaders, religious leaders from all over the world were brought into a room for a weekend, and they were asked a single question. They said the question essentially was, what's up? You know, what's going on? What's happening on this planet? And the outcome of that symposium was so profound that the journal Scientific American released a special edition in September of 2005. The listeners, you can go online, you can Google it and read it in its entirety, to bring the rest of the world up to speed with what this group had identified as the unprecedented number and magnitude of crises for our time in history. And the title of the special edition, I think, tells the whole story. The title was Crossroads for Planet Earth. Crossroads for Planet Earth. So from this, the scientific community was very much on board, and it was the first time the public was made aware in a mainstream fashion that we are, in fact, in a time of crisis. This is not business as usual. They laid out the problems. They laid out the challenges. They said, we've got to solve these things quick. And any one of the crises that doesn't get solved is enough to bring the world to its knees and destroy the very things that we cherish. And it's all about us working together. So the scientists were on board. It's a time of crises. Now, when we look at that, and I think this is no accident, that within the next couple of years, as we draw to the close of this great world age and we're faced with all these crises, and we are faced with the choice of either cooperating and working together or making the mistakes of the past and fighting and losing the things that we cherish. There's another factor here that I think can't be overlooked, and it's very, very interesting to see how it's unfolding. Because of the economic crisis, the United States, for right now, have put some of our science and technology on hold, including our space exploration. So we're not going back to the moon or Mars in the next couple of years. However, two other nations are, and that's India and China. Both have the technology, and they're both preparing now for lunar missions. There's a lot of speculation, and I worked in the defense and aerospace industry back in the 80s, dealing with data that came from the 1970s, from the space program, and there's a growing body of scientific evidence that we will probably find some remnant of an archaeological remnant of an ancient civilization on the moon. The photographs strongly suggest it. NASA now is releasing those through Freedom of Information. People have gotten some of this data. And there's a lot of speculation around, you know, what our astronauts actually found and other their books and videos and talk shows and PBS specials that go into all of that. But the key to me is this. When we, as a planet, get back to the moon, where we haven't been officially since the 70s, and we find this archaeological evidence that's there, and for some people they're going to say, oh, you know, it's proof of life beyond this world, and that may very well be, Richard, but my strong sense, and from the people in the industry and people I'm working with, my strong sense is that we're going to find archaeological evidence that's not so much from other worlds, but it's us.
Okay.
From another cycle.
Uh-huh.
Where we transcended the differences that have led to our destruction and were able to at least achieve lunar missions in a past cycle. And there, I know it sounds outrageous to some people, and for others, you know exactly what I'm talking about. When mm-hmm. you get into the data and the research and the archaeological remnants and the texts. But here's the thing. I think the fact that that is happening so close to the end of this cycle, when we're trying to make the choice as to whether or not we work together and cooperate, I think that would be one of the most unifying experiences that humankind could ever have, would be to return to a planet and find evidence of us from another cycle, saying this is what we can do, this is what we can achieve when we work together. We did it in the past. Let's try this again and see if we can't get it right, and how far beyond this can we go from the future.
Mm.
And what a powerful, unifying experience. And I'm speculating, I think this is a Gregism. I think this is what we'll see, and I think it might be something like this that tips the scales of balance in our favor as we come to this, the close yeah. of the cycle. It's going to be fascinating to see how governments deal with it, how information outlets deal with it, how media deals with it. That's a factor that I just wanted to throw in here.
Well, I think it's an excellent factor. And, of course, that's the other issue, too, is that there are people who have stated that there are beings from other worlds that have been here. And, of course, that's not what you're referring to. But nonetheless, they have ignored or denied the existence thereof. I don't know whether it really was or wasn't an alien ship and an alien being in Area 51. All I know is there was a lot of controversy over it. It was like, you know, if you just shut up and let the people speculate all they wanted, it might have just blown over. So now I'm sitting here wondering, if they do find evidence of us from a previous cycle on the moon, are they going to acknowledge that fact?
You know, well, the lunar shots, you may remember toward the end of last year, there was a very controversial project to shoot a rocket into a crater on the moon, kicking the pretense was to kick up enough dust to see if there's water on the moon.
Mm-hmm.
And the cameras from that craft, as it was moving very rapidly toward the crater, the cameras were sending back pictures to the Earth until it impacted and destroyed the camera. Those are now a public record. Richard Hoagland is sharing those. You know, NASA, it's NASA information, and that's, we paid for them.
Mm-hmm.
So, and the enhancements on images like that are showing very anomalous artifacts in these craters. They're not natural artifacts. What they are, we probably aren't going to know for sure until somebody goes back, but
yeah.
they strongly suggest that there's some kind of intelligent architecture that's not wind-blown, you know, or from some strange anomalous of a meteor impact. And when we overlay that, again, I was trained as a scientist, and there's nothing in my scientific background that prepares me for things like that. But when you overlay that kind of evidence, I mean, the photographic evidence, with the traditions that have survived, the written traditions and things like the Mahabharata, for example, the 100,000-line epic poem that is essentially the Bible of the Hindu tradition. And much of that happens in the time before this last cycle that has always been thought to be fairy tales and just make-believe.
Yeah.
And there are parts of that Mahabharata, there are elements of that that are now being archaeologically verified in India and Pakistan today, and they're saying, wow. So there are parts of the Mahabharata that are factual. What else in the Mahabharata is actually factual?
Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, it's interesting, and it's interesting we have to take it all together because it's all happening in this window of time. We're faced with the great challenges of our time, and we're being asked to make a choice to either cooperate or compete, to fight one another or work together to get through the end of a natural cycle. And we're being given a lot of different reasons to work together. We're being given a lot of different reasons to transcend our differences of the past. The scientific evidence of the power of cooperation is one of those reasons. Knowing about the cycles is one of those reasons. And how they work and where what we can reasonably expect. And now this information from whatever happens from these manned space landings may very well provide additional information. And I think we'll just have to wait and see.
You speculate, of course, that we may find evidence of a previous cycle of humans who went to the moon. And yet we have, I remember hearing, listening to a CD of yours where you spoke about evidence of a previous cycle of man that could only be explained because of man. I believe it was somewhere in India where the sands had been turned to glass. And there's only one thing that logically you could conclude would have caused the sheet of glass to have been created.
Well, this is, again, this could be a whole program unto itself, Richard. There are a number of locations in Egypt, Turkey, and what is now India and Pakistan. It all used to be considered India until it was partitioned. Archaeologists began finding things that shouldn't be there. And one of the things they began finding early in the 20th century, late 19th and 20th century, was areas, huge areas in the desert where the sand had been turned to glass. It's a greenish colored glass from the quartz and the sand being fused together through a rapid and intense heat. It's quick enough to melt, but it's hot enough to melt it, but it's so fast it fuses it and it doesn't turn molten.
Mm-hmm.
And that's indicative of a very certain kind of process. Early in the late 1800s, early 1900s, nobody knew what that was. They thought maybe it was a meteor impact or maybe it was lightning causing something that are called fugolites in the sand, but it really didn't explain, you know, what was being found there. It was only with the detonation of the first atomic bomb in southern New Mexico, where that glass was what lined the crater from the atomic blast, that scientists began asking themselves a question: is it possible that somehow ancient civilizations, we don't know if they actually had a bomb, but did they somehow reach a point where they understood about fusion and nuclear energy? Well, where this gets really interesting is there are archaeological sites now that are being unearthed, and part of this is in Rajasthan, the Rajasthan area between India and Pakistan. It's kind of it's in northwest India. The archaeological sites, first of all, they are advanced civilizations that were laid out on regular grid works. They had hot and cold running water in the homes. They had closed sewage systems. They had glass in the windows. They had art, high art. They had a language that to this day has never been translated. We don't know what these people left to us because we still cannot read their language. It's called Indus Valley Script is the name of the language. But where this starts to get really interesting is some of the sites, the archaeologists had to dig through a layer of radioactive ash before they could get to the sites, and the skeletons of the people are all, in the archaeological term, what the actual report says, they're in postures of flight. They're fleeing. They're running. They're all found at one end of one of the cities, as if they're running from something, and the bodies that are left, you know, mothers are clutching children, and fathers are embracing their family, and pets are right there with them. And what makes it really interesting is that so many of the skeletons are much more radioactive than they should be, just from being in the earth over time, from natural background radiation, about 50 times more radioactive is what the archaeological reports say than they should be. So the question is, what would, and the floors of the buildings, they're granite floors that have been vitrified, and what that means is they've been exposed to a heat that was so high it melted the quartz in the granite. The floors are still there, mm-hmm. but the granite has, the quartz has been melted in place, and the pots, the vases that are in the rooms have all been exposed to heat that has reduced them to, you know, just a pile of clay, of molten clay.
Mm-hmm.
So the question is, what could have happened in the past to cause something like that? And again, they go back to the Mahabharata, and it details a great battle that was waged at the end of the last cycle. And in the course of the battle, one side was losing, and they used a weapon that had never been used before. And the way the weapon is described is the parallel that a lot of researchers are drawing between then and now. The Mahabharata actually identifies the use of the weapon as a detonation. They say it was detonated, and it burst with the power of 10,000 suns. And when the light of this weapon reached the birds in the sky, they turned to ash and they fell from the sky. And the rivers boiled and the streams boiled and the fish were killed and the humans lost the flesh from their bodies and their fingernails and hair fell out. Mm. And the truth is, we don't know what happened, but the evidence now parallels what's written in the text. And the text is describing something that was, I mean, in the 1800s when people were reading these texts, nobody had any idea what that could be. Now the only thing that we know that could cause that kind of an effect is some kind of a nuclear blast or an atomic or nuclear fusion or an atomic blast.
Right.
So we have to ask, something happened in the past a long time ago. What was it? And the fact that it happened at the close of the cycle in a war where people were fighting then over resources and beliefs, I think cannot be overlooked in terms of where we are in our lives right now.
Now, I asked
a long answer to a short question.
Well, no, I love the long answers because it gives great description. And the reason that I had you bring that up or describe that is because I wanted people to understand that there is evidence of us existing prior to 5,000 years ago. And,
oh, absolutely.
You know, we
absolutely
can't escape that.
Absolutely. There, you know, this is called, there's a new branch of science that is rapidly becoming an acknowledged branch. It is called OOPARTS, OOPARTS, and it is an acronym for out-of-place artifacts. So in other words, there's an acknowledged scientific history of civilizations of the world and where we came from and where we are now, and it's pretty much a linear kind of a chart that says civilization as we know it began about 5,000 years ago, interestingly, and that's what's taught in the classrooms and in the textbooks. We learned it, we were in school, our kids are learning it today. However, there are so many anomalous sites that are being dated at pre-5,000 years that used to be called anomalous. You know, the scientists would say, we'll come back and study those later. But now that so many are emerging that it looks like it's telling us that our understanding needs some revision. So, for example, we're looking at one of the sites that I've actually been to is on the high plains of Bolivia, just across the Peruvian border, 12,000 feet above sea level. They're looking at essentially an ancient seaport town, 12,000 feet above sea level in an area called Tiahuanaco, which is a very mysterious site, and is now being dated at about 12 to 15,000 years old. So that means that site was there before the last ice age or during the last ice age. And that would be two cycles, at least two cycles, behind where we are right now.
Mm-hmm.
We're seeing anomalous evidence in Turkey. The archaeological sites in Turkey are in Giza, in Egypt. The Giza Plateau is now recognized. Well, we thought it was sitting on bedrock, and now we know it's actually sitting on top of a complex, a network of chambers that run underneath the Giza Plateau, and the Sphinx and the pyramids appear to be the tops of some of those monuments. And if that's the case, then they're much, much older than the 4,000 or 5,000 years that we've been looking at. What all of this says is we don't know all of the answers. What we do know is that the way we see ourselves now, I'm not going to say it's wrong. I think there's a growing body of scientific evidence suggesting that it's incomplete. And as we flesh out the implications of the new information, it's leading to the conclusion, and from my perspective, the data is clear, but it will take a long time for the textbooks to actually reflect this, I think, is that we are influenced by these cosmic cycles in terms of the rise and fall of civilization and what we achieve and how we deal with the changes, and the propensity for humans to fight one another at the close of the cycles has led us to lose some of the things that we cherish the most in our civilization, including civilization itself. And knowing that, looking into the world today, we've got to ask ourselves, are we making those mistakes? There are a lot of parallels between then and now, but I believe that we've given ourselves an edge, an evolutionary edge, because we now know about the cycles, and we have the technology that helps us to get through the earth changes.
Mm.
You know, when there's an earthquake in one part of the world, the rest of the world converges with medicine and food and aid and transportation and communications. And, you know, we can help one another that way.
Yeah.
But the key is, do we honor ourselves as a family and commit ourselves to that kind of cooperation? And that's a question that we're answering by the way we live our lives right now.
Absolutely. You're listening to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Duguid with my special guest, Greg Braden. Don't go away. There's more to come.
If we leave here today, we could be 1,000 miles away. Take to that road. See how far it goes. And on that great ocean road, all the trouble that you know empties out as you go. Walk with me, talk with me, tell me your stories.
This is Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Duguid with special guest Greg Braden as we continue talking about 2012 and his book, Fractal Time. What is our purpose here? What is it that we're trying to achieve? I certainly hope it's not another Tower of Babel, because we kind of saw what happened there.
Well, when we talk about, it's a very good question, and there are actually many questions within the question that you've just asked. And when we talk about what we're trying to achieve, to me, there's a different answer from that than what is our purpose. And I think if we're going to talk about the purpose of the cycle, we end up talking about the purpose of life in general. And there's a whole conversation and a lot of research I'd love to share about that. I think for the purpose of where we are in our cycle right now, what you identified in the 60s, I think is something that could happen again if the mainstream, broad, general audience were made aware of what's happening to them in their lives, what's happening to our civilization, what's happening to our planet, why it's happening, if it were done on a responsible, fact-based level, without the fear and without the speculation. I think that people would rally around transforming our world to help one another get through a cyclic change that has driven the rise and fall of civilizations in the past. every audience that I've spoken to, in the last 5 years, I've been on almost every continent. I haven't been to Antarctica because there's no Barnes and Noble in Antarctica. But I've, excluding Antarctica, I've been to every continent of the Earth, not every country, but every continent. And I've spoken to people from so many different traditions and cultures and backgrounds. And it's amazing how many sense that what I'm describing is precisely what's happening, and they're struggling to give voice to the change.
Mm-hmm.
It's not something that we've seen on, you know, CNN or on the New York Times, and that's where people tend to look to find validation before they will take action that something is happening. They said, this is really going on. How come we haven't seen it on the news? You know, or how come I haven't read it in USA Today? But I think if a responsible effort were underway to inform people not only of the uniqueness of our time, but of the kinds of things that we can do to empower ourselves just in our daily lives. These are big changes.
Yeah.
And so a lot of people, when they hear them, they say, you know, man, what can I do? And there are a lot of things that we can do. There are socially responsible ways of living our lives day in and day out that contribute to our collective answer to our time in history. But as I share this with people throughout the world, when they see, number one, they can see the cycles in the ice cores, and that's unbiased. It's just the science. And the cycles are so obvious, and they see where we are, that the conditions of Earth right now are where we always are in these cycles, and it tells them that the Earth isn't broken and that we haven't necessarily done anything wrong. Now, I'm a little aside to that. I just want to be very clear. We definitely need to change the way we live our lives.
Mm-hmm.
We definitely need to clean up this planet. We definitely need to get off of fossil fuels, use fewer plastics. We definitely need to find new ways to power our civilization. Having said that, I have to say that the science shows us that we are in the midst of a cyclic process, and that it is more about the way we deal with one another than the way we deal with the Earth itself.
Hmm.
And when people can see those things, when they see, you know, that it's up to us to help one another, it changes everything. And when they can see the cycles, it makes sense to them why the changes are happening. Without that, I have this conversation with my mom all the time. I try to have dinner with my mom on the way to the airport or on the way home from the airport whenever I go on a tour. And just recently, we were having a meal, and mom said to me, in her very technically based language, she just said, you know, it looks to me like the world went to hell in a handbasket.
Yeah.
The way mom sees it. Because mm-hmm. the changes appear to be separate, non-related, disjointed, and all happening at the same time. And when we can see that there is an underlying thread that is driving these changes, and that they've happened before and where we are, then it shifts our perspective about the way we think of our time, and people begin to feel, and I mean, there's a sense of relief, rather than waiting for the world to end 2 or 3 years from now, knowing that we're already living these changes, and the way we experience much of it is going to be determined by how we respond to what the world is showing us, and that we can do it in our everyday lives.
And I really want to thank you for taking the time to share with us. We look forward to having you back on a regular basis. We'd actually like to have you back on the program once in every seasonal cycle, so 4 times a year if possible, to expound further on what you've found, what research has divulged, if you will, and maybe through this process we can learn that we need to coexist. And again, I thank you so much for being on the program today.
Well, thank you for being such a gracious host. Thank you for all you do, Richard. God bless. Take good care. And I want to thank all of your listeners for everything they do every day in their lives to make this a better world. We appreciate you tremendously.
And we certainly do appreciate Greg Braden as well. A reminder that at Paradise Found, they're having the equivalent of the metaphysical wine tasting, all kinds of different activities you can participate in at 17 East Annapamu. Until next Saturday at this same time, I'm Richard Dugan, your host for Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. Love to all.